This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Roxane Gay has written a new memoir that she describes as, quote, about living in the world when you are not a few or even 40 pounds overweight. This is a book about living in the world when you are 300 or 400 pounds overweight, unquote. But the book is about much more than that. It's about the consequences of being gang raped when she was 12, back when she was thin. She thinks her body size is one of those consequences. It's about being the daughter of middle-class Haitian immigrants and not fitting into the narrative of blackness. It's about being a feminist. It's about starting to identify as lesbian but still being attracted to men. It's about living with contradictions. Roxane Gay is best known for her best-selling collection of essays, Bad Feminist. She's also a novelist and short story writer and has been a contributing opinion writer to the New York Times. She teaches English at Purdue University. Her new memoir is called Hunger. Roxane Gay, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start by having you read from the beginning of your book. Would you read a couple of paragraphs from that for us?
I'd be happy to. The story of my body is not a story of triumph. This is not a weight loss memoir. There will be no picture of a thin version of me, my slender body emblazoned across this book's cover, with me standing in one leg of my former, fatter self's jeans. This is not a book that will offer motivation. I don't have any powerful insight into what it takes to overcome an unruly body and unruly appetites. Mine is not a success story. Mine is simply a true story. I wish so very much that I could write a book about triumphant weight loss and how I learned to live more effectively with my demons. I wish I could write a book about being at peace and loving myself wholly at any size. Instead, I have written this book, which has been the most difficult writing experience of my life, one far more challenging than I could have ever imagined. When I set out to write Hunger, I was certain the words would come easily the way they usually do. And what could be easier to write about than the body I have lived in for more than 40 years? But I soon realized I was not only writing a memoir of my body, I was forcing myself to look at what my body has endured, the weight I gained, and how hard it has been to both live with and lose that weight. I've been forced to look at my guiltiest secrets. I've cut myself wide open. I am exposed. That is not comfortable. That is not easy.
Thanks for reading that. So you write about how difficult it was to write this book. Why did it feel necessary to write?
It felt necessary to write because it's the book I wanted to write the least. When I was thinking about what to do next in terms of nonfiction just before Bad Feminist came out, I thought, you know, I really would never want to write about fatness. And in that moment, I knew that's something I have to write about.
So you write that at your heaviest, you were 577 pounds, you're 6'3". Since we're going to be talking in part about your body and your body size, I would appreciate it if you would guide me about what language you'd like me to use in terms of describing the size of your body. Honestly, words are so loaded when it comes to body image, and everybody has their own preference for what word they use, so I'd like you to guide me on that.
I think fat works well.
Good, I'm good with that. Okay. So I'm sure some people are thinking, like, if you have weighed that much, why didn't you have bariatric surgery? And you have a really interesting chapter in your book about how in your late 20s, you went to an introductory session with your father, and you both decided you did not want to go through with it. What were some of the risks and the life-changing differences involved with this kind of procedure?
Well, bariatric surgery is dangerous surgery. In many ways, you realter your anatomy and have your stomach made smaller. And in certain procedures, they take out part of your intestines. It makes you nutrient deprived for the rest of your life. And the success rate is not great. In the immediate, you absolutely do lose a great deal of weight in a short amount of time. But in the long term, we're still waiting to see just how successful it is.
You write that you began eating to change your body after you were gang raped when you were 12. I got so angry reading that part of the story, the boy you thought of as kind of your boyfriend set you up for this. You were on a bike ride with him in the woods. You stopped at a cabin where his friends were waiting to attack you. And your, you know, you thought boyfriend was part of it. You write you didn't know what rape was. So what was your comprehension of what had happened to you?
I had very little comprehension of what happened to me. I was stunned, and I just assumed, okay, we just had sex. And I didn't realize that there was a thing called rape. I didn't realize that there was a vocabulary to describe the experience and that it wasn't my fault. I thought I didn't fight enough, I didn't get away, and so I was complicit in what happened.
You must have asked yourself, why did they choose you? What did your 12-year-old self think about that?
You know, my 12-year-old self thought, oh, I must have asked for this. Not in the way, you know, we say she asked for it, but I just thought I deserved it because I was that weak, that gullible, and just that easily manipulated by some random boy I thought I knew.
You went home. You didn't tell your parents. You must have been emotionally and physically so deeply wounded. Even your clothes must have been a mess. How were you able to cover up what happened?
I, to this day, don't know how I was able to cover up what happened. I just remember sneaking up to my room and doing my best to hide my clothes and to hide myself for as long as I could, to just try and pull myself together. And I did because, you know, I was a really good kid. I did what I was supposed to. And I think when you're a really good kid, you know how to play that role and you know how to hide that anything is wrong.
Initially, what were your fears about what would happen if you told your parents?
You know, I was 12, and so my fears were really that I was going to get in trouble and that I was going to go to hell because I had had premarital sex. You know, we were Catholic and very devout Catholics. And though my parents raised us with the understanding that God was a God of love, I was really terrified nonetheless.
But the boys who raped you, they did tell. They told their version of the story, which was not your version of the story. They told it in school. You had a reputation after that of being a slut. So to what extent were you able to keep a secret when the boys had kind of, you know, told this version? I don't know what that version of the story was, but they told their version of the story. And I guess people in the school, you know, believed it. So
yeah, the other students in school believed it. I walked into class, and I think it was French class, and I was sitting in my seat, and the kid behind me tapped my shoulder and said, "You're a slut." And for the rest of the day, I realized that pretty much everyone in school knew what had happened. And, well, they knew the boys' version of what had happened. And that's when I realized, oh, I can really never tell my family because I will bring this much shame into our home.
What was the boy's version of the story?
The boy's version of the story was that it was my choice and that I wanted it and that I initiated it.
And did you speak up for yourself in school, or were you too afraid to engage at all with the story?
I didn't engage at all. I just shut down completely, and I would go to class and try and hide in class by sitting in the back, and I would just endure the taunts, and then, you know, eventually, as it is in middle school, you know, the story moved on, but my reputation never changed. I was still an outcast. I was still a loser.
So where does eating come in with the rape story?
You know, after I was raped, I needed comfort, and I felt so weak, and I felt so powerless, and I wanted to make myself bigger. And so I would overeat, and I would get quite a lot of comfort from that. And, you know, when you are 12 and 13 and 14 and 15 and, you know, a sheltered kid from the suburbs, you don't really have access to vices other than food. And so I ate.
You write that you thought if your body became repulsive, you could keep men away.
I did. I just, you know, I grew up in this world where fat phobia is pervasive, and I just thought, well, boys don't like fat girls. And so if I'm fat, they won't want me and they won't hurt me again. But more than that, I really wanted to just be bigger so that I could fight harder.
I'm thinking about all the changes that must have been going on through your body at this time. Most teenagers have very ambivalent feelings about their body as they go through puberty and then learn to live within their new bodies. You know, you have hormonal changes. Your body is going through physical changes. You're becoming more sexual. People start to see you more sexually. And I think there's a lot of confusion that comes along with that. So you're going through all of that. You're also recovering or trying to recover from being raped. And your body is also changing as a result of this excessive eating that you're doing in an attempt to become larger. So your feelings about your own body must have been so complicated during that period.
In some ways they were, and in some ways they weren't. I feel like I gained so much weight in high school, and everyone in my life was so focused on my weight gain that I didn't have a lot of the typical body issues or body concerns that you have as a teenager. I didn't even get my period until I was 15. And so I went through, you know, like the hormonal changes and so on, but I was so afraid of the idea of sex that I pretty much just allowed myself to have this fantasy idea of boyfriends rather than to ever think that I was going to be part of the dating world. My, you know, my body was just expanding. And so that is kind of what I was focused on, whether I wanted to be or not.
So you went to Exeter and then you went to Yale. So you were living away from home during your high school and college years.
Mm-hmm.
Did that make it easier to eat without restriction?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Especially during the first 2 years of high school, I just went crazy with food. And it was amazing to have access to so much food, not only on campus, but off. And in college, of course, there were even more opportunities because New Haven is a much bigger town than Exeter. And so it just, you know, I lost my mind.
So when you were in college, you fell in love with theater. I guess earlier than that, you fell in love with theater. You went to Yale in part because of their theater department. And you worked behind the scenes. Was that a way of being involved with storytelling and with people, but also being kind of invisible because you were literally off stage?
Absolutely. It was a way of being a part of something because I'm not a joiner. I never was. And so I was never really interested in extracurriculars. I did them because that's what you do to get into a good college. But theater is where I found my passion and being behind the scenes because I didn't want to be seen. I just wanted to be useful. And technical theater allowed me that space. It was the best memories I have of high school and the first 2 years of college are connected to theater.
I suppose writing gives you that too, the ability to say what you want and have people look at your work without looking physically at you.
Well, that's what I hoped.
Oh, you're too famous now. You can't get away with it. There's
no.
The internet. And that you travel all over giving speeches and you're on TV. I mean, people know what you look like.
They do. You know, one of the many reasons I'm a writer is because I didn't want to be like an actor on a stage or on the screen. And
too late.
Whoops.
So how is that for you?
Oh, it's, you know, I'm afraid of public speaking, so I've had to learn how to do it. And it's gotten much better. And I actually do enjoy doing these events and connecting with audiences because I have a really passionate audience. And it's a privilege to do. I hate doing television. Not because I'm on television, but because when I go on TV, the amount of hate mail and the amount of trolling I get on social media is unbearable. And so I try not to make myself that kind of a target as often as possible.
So when you're trolled on the internet and social media, do you think that has to do at all with describing yourself as a feminist because there's so much, like, anti-feminist trolling.
Oh, yeah, like, I would say 40% of my trolling is because I'm a feminist, 30% of my trolling is because I'm Black, and 30% of my trolling is because I'm fat.
I love that you have it broken down into percentages.
Yeah, I do.
Is there any percentage where it's,
so
like,
many
it's
trolls.
All three, like they hate you because
oh God,
you're
yes.
Black and feminist and fat?
Oh, yeah. The Venn diagram of my trolls would be a circle.
My guest is Roxane Gay. Her new memoir is called Hunger. You've Googled your rapist, the boy who took you to the cabin where you were gang raped. You mm-hmm. even called him in his office, but not spoken, but heard him mm-hmm. pick up the phone and say, hello, hello. Why have you done that? And do you have any idea what his life is like now? Like, who, if he's married, like, where, mm-hmm. what he's doing?
I don't know much about what his life is like. I know what he does, and I know where he works, where he worked last time I Googled him, which was a few years ago. So I don't know what his life is like, but I can imagine. And, you know, one day I just thought, where is this man? And I wanted to know. I just all of a sudden wanted to know, and I felt like I needed to know for my safety. And it was like a little weird panic moment. And then I just wanted to know, just out of curiosity, like, how did your life go on when you tried to end mine? And so I consulted Dr. Google, and Dr. Google came through.
So what did it feel like to hear his voice and to make this indirect connection with him?
It was creepy. And I actually, in that moment, was like, girl, what are you doing? And then I almost, like, you know, part of me wanted to say something and to just scream at him. But I just hung up.
It sounds like the beginning of a thriller.
Doesn't it?
Yes.
Lifetime movie coming next month.
Don't you want to know what impact it had on his life? And if I'm not suggesting you actually call him and ask, but don't you wonder what impact it has on his life, and if he thinks about it, and if it haunts him, and if he feels bad, and if he has any idea what a horrible thing he did?
Of course, I wonder all the time. I mean, and you know what the wondering really is that I want him to say I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I want him to acknowledge that this terrible thing happened and that it wasn't my fault. I want him to know that, like, I didn't just walk it off, and that I was broken for a really long time because of it. You know, and I'm never going to get that.
At the end of your book, you write, I no longer need the body fortress I built. I need to tear down some of the walls for me and me alone. Can you elaborate on that, about what walls you'd like to tear down?
Well, I would definitely like to tear down sort of this wall I've built around myself, because I don't need it anymore. And I know that intellectually. And I on good days, I know that emotionally. And it's not, I don't want to be thin. I want to be smaller, because I just do. I think it makes so many things easier just on a day-to-day basis. And also, I have no small amount of vanity. So I just want to be able to find cuter clothes. Like, sometimes it's really just basic things that I would like for myself. And, you know, I think getting rid of the fortress is the final step that I need to take in just moving on from this thing that happened to me once.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it'll be easier to move on now that you've written about it and it's out there, it's not a secret?
Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, I do. I did not anticipate that when I wrote the book. I wasn't writing the book to heal myself or anything like that. But in writing the book, I was really forced to take a look at some of the habits I've developed over the years, and I've been able to acknowledge that I don't need these behaviors anymore. And I would like to come up with different behaviors that serve me more effectively. And so I don't know that it will be easier, but I do know that I am in the best emotional and mental space that I've ever been in to at least try.
Roxane Gay, it's really been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Roxane Gay's new memoir is called Hunger. My guest Sherman Alexie has written a new memoir about growing up on the Spokane Indian Reservation in the state of Washington. His mother was one of the few people who could still speak the native language, but she didn't teach it to him. He grew up surrounded by poverty, alcoholism, and violence. He was pretty young when he realized he wanted to get off the reservation and go to college. He succeeded in doing that and in becoming an award-winning writer. He won the 1993 Penn Faulkner Award for his short story collection, The Lone Ranger and Tonto, Fistfight in Heaven. In 2007, he won the National Book Award for Young People's Literature for his book, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. Alexie's new memoir includes poems with titles like How to Be an Atheist at a Spokane Indian Christian Funeral, The Urban Indian Boy Enjoys Good Health Insurance, and After Brain Surgery. He had his first brain surgery when he was 5 months old and his most recent in 2015. He's a writer with a lot of stories to tell. Sherman Alexie, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with a reading from deep in the book, but this is a theme that kind of recurs through the book.
Okay, yes, this is chapter 117, All My Relations.
People can think it's like 10,000 pages long, this book. It's not.
Most of those chapters are one page or one poem. So the title of this chapter is All My Relations. I am related by blood and marriage to men who hit women and to men and women who hit children and to men and women in jail and in prison and on parole for stealing and robbing and raping and shooting and stabbing and punching and kicking and forging and abetting and neglecting and manslaughtering and murdering and dealing and buying and muling and abandoning and vandalizing and breaking and entering and jacking and driving without insurance and driving under the influence and driving without a license and vehicular homiciding and shoplifting and deserting and violating and failing to pay on time and failing to pay at all and failing to yield and failing to stop and failing and failing and failing and failing.
Right, that's Sherman Alexie reading from his new memoir, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. Are passages like that going to make you very unpopular with some Native Americans, including maybe some members of your family and some friends?
Well, I imagine so.
I like the way you said that.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not on purpose to offend them, but when you tell the truth, it's naturally going to offend people afraid of the truth, afraid of what the truth might force them to do, especially other artists, academics, intellectuals, writers in the Native world have to reconcile and reckon with their own lives, their own families. I'm reminded, I was at Stanford University recently, and a young student asked me how I felt when white people used my books as weapons against other Indians. And I found that remarkable, I said to him, that you think that question is new, but I've been getting asked that since 1987. Then it also presumes that I, as a Native American, have nothing to show or teach people who are not Native American, that my story, my lived experience, has nothing to say of any importance to anybody but other Native Americans, and that's not true. So I think that student's question and that entire line of questioning by anybody is really sort of a sign of racial and ethnic and cultural insecurity.
Well, your memoir starts at a dangerous New Year's Eve party thrown by your parents in your home. In 1972 or 1973, you're 6 or 7. Everyone is drunk. You write child molesters are there. And you try to barricade shut your bedroom door to prevent anyone from getting in, particularly the child molesters. Your father ends up in a drunken fight. Your mother's so upset she takes you and your siblings away from the reservation, but then realizes she has no place to go. So she and you go back to the reservation. Why did you want to start the book there?
Well, that New Year's Eve party was the bottom for my mother. You know, the morning at the party, I saw her punch another Indian woman in the face. It's the most overt act of violence I ever saw my mother commit. Bloodied another Indian woman's mouth, and that other Indian woman was screaming. In fact, I can still hear that sound, you know, that keening. And the next morning, she woke us up, really early in the morning, pre-dawn, and drove us to Chewila, where she was born, a little white town now that, but for centuries, was a gathering place for our tribes. And there, she promised us that she would never drink again. And despite all the bipolar dysfunction she displayed and sometimes the emotional and spiritual cruelty and occasional physical cruelty in the years after that, she never drank again. That's when she got sober. And our house became a safe place. Prior to that, it was not a safe place. But after my mother sobered up, there was no alcohol allowed in the house, and that saved us.
Even though your father continued to drink?
Well, he continued to drink, but he had to leave to drink. So he wanted to leave anyway, but he would go on binge drinking journeys back to his reservation, the Coeur d'Alene Indian Reservation in Idaho. So he would leave us to pursue some drunken vision of his childhood. And he would be gone for days or weeks at a time, but he was not allowed to drink in the house.
So among other things, your mother was one of the few remaining people, one of the maybe five people who still knew the native language, the Salish language. So she was really looked up to for that, and she was, it sounds like in a lot of ways, she was an important member of the community because of that. So I was wondering if you feel like you were brought up in the middle of the two ends of what a lot of people think about when they think about Indians. You know, like, there's two stereotypes. One is, like, they're mystical and spiritual, and the other is they're poor and drunk on the reservation. I'm sure some truth in the mystical and spiritual part and some truth in the poverty and alcoholism on reservations.
Well, you know, I've spent a few decades now in the recovery community and, in fact, spent 90 days in the summer of 2010 in a rehab facility for my bipolarism. And I've spent a lot of time in those recovery groups and in recovery with a wide range of people from various ethnic groups, racial groups, economic classes. And the idea of a house being a party house where people would gather to party and that it was dangerous and filled with sexual assaulters and potential murderers is actually very universal. So when you look at damaged adults of any kind, you're going to find damaged parents and damaged families. And religion often has a lot to do with it. Fundamentalist Christianity is not so different in its various dysfunctions from the fundamentalist varieties of tribal religions. So I recognize in a lot of survivors of Christian fundamentalism the same sort of post-traumatic stress disorder that I have.
So this might be too personal, but when you say you spent a lot of time in recovery communities, was that for your own recovery or being the child of somebody who's in recovery?
Well, I'm the child. I am in recovery. I've been sober now for 26 years, but I am bipolar. I do have post-traumatic stress disorder. A recent study from Johns Hopkins studying reservations found that Indian children on reservations have the same rate of PTSD as combat veterans. So I imagine if they did that study in poor white communities or other poor minority communities, they'd find the same sort of numbers. But I have various emotional problems caused by brain disorders and brain chemistry, but also by trauma. So it's hard to separate. You know, it's the chicken of egg of my alphabet soup of mental illness acronyms and abbreviations.
Yeah, and let me just mention here, you were born with hydrocephalus, which is an over, like, too much spinal fluid pressing on the brain. So you needed surgery for that when you were 5 months old.
Yeah, I've had three brain surgeries. I had brain surgery at 5 months old, 2 years old, and then in December of 2015 to remove a benign tumor.
My guest is Sherman Alexie. His new memoir is called You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. After a break, we'll talk about leaving the reservation and the brain surgery he had 2 years ago to remove a benign tumor. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with Sherman Alexie. His new memoir, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, is about growing up on the Spokane Indian Reservation in Washington. It's also about how and why he left the reservation. He's an award-winning novelist and short story writer. You initially went to a reservation school, and you asked to go to another school because You knew you wanted to get off the reservation for good. How did you know that?
Well, as we've said earlier, I had brain surgery when I was a kid. And I spent most of my first 7 years of my life off the reservation, in and out of hospitals for speech therapy, physical therapy, occupational therapy. So it ended up being, as a toddler, that my primary peer group was white adult doctors, nurses, social workers, therapists, nuns, priests at the Catholic hospitals. You know, you become who you're with. So in those early formative years, I was primarily influenced by all these obsessive compulsive workaholic white people who'd gone to college. So I was imprinted by white college graduates. I was like a little duckling following this white doctors and nurses who were wondering, what's this strange feathered creature following me? So at the, you know, at the time I was being raised by my native family, of course, I was being influenced by them, but I was also being influenced by white folks in a way that natives of my generation on my reservation did not receive them. I was being given so much kindness and care. I was being taken care of in a way by white folks that natives on my reservation of my generation were not. They pretty much only got the terrible teachers. Their primary memories of white folks are negative. Mine are more mixed. Mine are more about how complicated all human beings are, that I saw the good and bad of our colonizers. And like a lot of really sick, like a lot of critically or terminally or even just moderately ill children who spend a lot of time in hospitals, when you ask them as kids what they want to be, a lot of them, an overwhelming number of them, will tell you they want to be a doctor.
You wanted to be a doctor for a while.
Yes. So I was motivated from the earliest ages to become a doctor, a pediatrician. I had a dream unlike anybody else in my little town. So I grew up in the tribal schools knowing that they weren't preparing me for college. I knew that from an early age. But more than that, they weren't even preparing me to even think about college, to do well at college. And then on the first day of seventh grade, I opened up my math book and my mom's name was written in it, my mom's maiden name. So I was looking at a 30-year-old math book. And at that moment, I knew because of my race and my class and rural geography for all these forces, not just about being Indian, but about being poor and about being from a small town, all these forces that crush all sorts of American kids, crush their hopes and dreams. I knew I had no chance unless I left and went to a better school.
And your parents allowed you to leave the reservation school and go to another school. What did it take? Was it hard to change schools?
No, it wasn't hard. It's still astonishing to me how easily my parents let me go. I came home that day and I said to them, I need to leave. And they both agreed quickly and without argument.
So this was a public school?
Yes, it was a public school, but I got extremely lucky. You know, I don't believe in magic, but I believe in interpreting coincidence exactly the way you want to. I ended up with a generation of white farm town kids who were brilliant in a private school kind of way. To give you one example, out of the 12 of us on my senior year basketball team, 11 of us went on to get bachelor's degrees, and 4 have gone on to get master's degree. This from a high school of 150 kids in a community of about 2,000 people. So it was an astonishingly talented, intellectual, and ambitious group of white farm kids who became my second tribe.
Some of the book is about the deaths of your parents. And I'd like you to read one of the poems that's included in your book. This is a very short poem called Benediction.
In writing this memoir and thinking about how to write a memoir, Mary Carr's art of memoir became very important to me. It became sort of my Bible for writing a memoir. And one of the things she was very clear about with examples was about how you had to be very honest about yourself. In writing a memoir and you're writing about other people, you had to be just as accurate and honest about yourself and your weaknesses as you are about other people's weaknesses. So this poem came out of that attempt at honesty, about personal honesty. I only spent a few hours with my mother as she lay dying in her rented hospital bed. I kissed her, told her I loved her, and then I fled.
When you write you fled, what do you mean?
I didn't want to be there when she died. I didn't feel strong enough on one level to be there, but I also didn't feel that I needed to be there, that I thought being there for me was something that was going to be damaging, and I thought it would be something of a lie.
Why did you think it would be damaging?
My relationship with my mother, after being so contentious for so many years, had settled into a truce after my father died in 2003. I maintained my love for her. I maintained the peace, and we stayed cordial by maintaining distance. I imagine she would have wanted me to be closer, to spend more time with her, but I stayed away in physical and emotional forms. I protected myself. I put on armor. And in order to be with her in those last moments, I would have had to take down that armor. And I couldn't do it.
Do you have any regrets about that?
Yes, and I'm sure they will grow. I mentioned a few times in the book that I'm highly anticipating the growth of my regrets. But my father, one of the great contradictions in my life, in my work, is that my father was a random, undependable alcoholic. He went on these binge drinking journeys all the time during my childhood, and I would cry myself into the emergency room, dehydrated into the emergency room because he was gone. And my mother was always there. She was the one who had jobs, who financially provided for us, who was predictable and consistent. She was industrious. And yet, I've always thought of my father as being the primary influence on my literary career. He was easy to love. That's why I thought that. He was easy to love. And my mother was difficult to love. And I fled him as he was dying and wasn't with him when he died. I pulled some indigenous version of Cats in the Cradle. and with my mother, it was the same thing. So I'm highly aware and readily admit that there was some personal weakness I'm still pondering and dealing with in not being with my parents when they died.
You write about your father's death. My father often abandoned me when I was a child, so to be blunt, I chose to leave him in the same way he'd left me. And you write that you visited him, but then you left and chose to be with your wife
and
children.
My
sons. Yeah.
And when I heard the news my dad died, I was in a toy store with my two sons. And the indigenous family I've created with my wife and my two sons, I chose that. I've made that work. And I've been the best person I can possibly be inside that family. The best version of me exists inside that family. So that's the most important thing to me.
A few months after your mother's death, you had surgery to remove a benign brain tumor. You had an experience that sounds a lot like a near-death experience, although you didn't nearly die, but the surgery had complications and you were bleeding a lot. It wasn't looking good for a while. Can you describe how you experienced that, like what your dream state was during that time?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I vividly remember certain events. It's funny. I remember when they put the drugs in. Like the sedative they put in is called midazolam, which is a perfect term for how it made you feel. Midazolam. And I remember being wheeled into the operating room, and there were a couple dozen people in there, and I heard so many accents. It was such a diverse room. My surgeon is East Indian, and then the room was filled with all sorts of first-generation immigrants. And you know, I was so happy. to be in that room. And I remember saying, you know, look at all the brown people. And they laughed. And that was my last memory. So if I had died, the last thing I would have been doing was celebrating all the, you know, brown healthcare professionals. But, you know, what they couldn't see before surgery with the MRIs and CAT scans is that my tumor had adhered to the dura, the brain, the sinus, the main vein across my brain. And they think that was probably due to my hydrocephalus, some after effects of my hydrocephalus as a child, that my brain did not react properly when they pulled the skull cap off, when they cut the skull to create the operating theater. They pulled the skull cap off and that tore the tumor, it tore my brain, it tore the sinus. So I started bleeding in a way that required transfusions. And I was never in critical condition, but I was in serious enough condition where my LeBron James of a surgeon called his colleague the Steph Curry of brain surgeons, and they discussed the next steps. So there was enough concern where there was a doctor consulting with another doctor. And in dreaming, I remember two dreams during surgery. And the first one was my mom and dad were on a hill above me in this field, and there was a light behind them shining. You know, very typical near-death experience imagery. But even inside my dream, I was suspicious. Well, what if this is real? What if that is heaven? What if my parents are gesturing toward me? And I've done so much dream therapy over the years. I've learned how to be active inside your own nightmares and dreams. So I flipped off my parents in my dream to tell them, no, I am not coming up that hill to that light. I am not, I am not, I am not. And looking back, I think that dream happened when my brain was bleeding. I think I knew I was in trouble.
So when you emerged after this maybe near-death experience, were you happy to be alive?
You know, it's been, I guess 19 months since surgery. And whenever I even ponder that question, as I'm pondering it now, I start to cry. Waking up after surgery is the greatest moment of my life. And it made me realize, despite all the trauma, despite all my past and current mental illnesses, despite any pain that I have, that my life, as I've constructed, as it has been constructed around me and for me, is something amazing. And I'm grateful for that. I am grateful to be an Indigenous man married to an Indigenous woman with Indigenous children in 21st century United States. I am happy to be here despite everything. And that feeling has made me a slightly different person. Last night in our hotel room, my wife and I, who's traveling with me, we were talking about how much I've changed because of brain surgery, and it just and I did mime. I said, "Well, it feels like this," and I was standing there in my boxers and undershirt, and I took a little shuffle 2 inches to the left, and then I shuffled back to the right, and then to the left, and I said, "It feels like I moved 3 inches to the left. I feel that much different," and it seems like it would be insignificant, but it's not. I am only probably 85% of who I used to be. But I think if you ask the people who know me best, most especially my wife and sons, they would tell you that I've become a slightly better person because of brain surgery.
What's the 15% that isn't there anymore?
Blind rage.
Oh, so you lost the bad stuff.
I lost a large part of the bad stuff, a certain part of the bad stuff, and I think that allows that are better parts of me to shine a little more.
So, you know, the title of your memoir, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, I suppose is a tribute to the, you know, a reference to the Dusty Springfield recording, a really great recording. So what does that recording mean to you?
Well, in searching for a title for the book, and I went through many, I just had the thought one day of looking at the top 10 songs of the year of my birth. Because my mom sang a lot, and she was always singing the songs on the radio, you know, Christian hymns, Spokane Indian tribal songs, and the songs on the radio. Music filled my childhood, as it does with a whole bunch of folks. So I looked at my birth year and I thought, what songs would my mother have been singing in my birth year? And I looked through the songs and I hit on Dusty Springfield's song, which of course I've heard, everybody's heard, everybody knows. Somebody called it the most heartbreaking love song of all time. And I don't disagree.
It seems to describe the challenging relationship you had with your mother who didn't overtly express her love to you.
You don't have to say you love me. I mean, sitting here right now, I can't remember a specific instance of her saying I love you.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is coming to mind. And not for my father either. My father hugged me twice in my life that I can remember. And my mother, in my adulthood, I can only remember side hugs.
Do you hug your kids a lot?
I am overtly huggy with my kids. I
okay.
kiss them a lot. I tell them I love them. I'm on the road, so I'm texting them constantly. I'm going to start crying again, but... We like to think that as parents, our love for our children is our love for our children as it is. But in being affectionate with my children, of making them aware of how much I love them, is also me attempting to fill the absence from my own childhood. In fact, as I write in the book a poem, you know, I wish in the poem that I could defy physics, defy time, and go back in time and be my mother's parent and adore her as a parent in the way I doubt she was ever adored. So I adore my children, as you should.
Sherman Alexie, it has been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Sherman Alexie's new memoir is called You Don't Have to Say You Love Me.